You're listening to the Hour of the Time, and what a time it is. I'm your host, William Cooper, for Swiss America Trading. As you know, a fire has caused us to move from WWCR. And when our friends at Swiss America Trading heard about the fire, they went right to work finding us another place to broadcast. Within just a matter of hours, a new station, this station, WRNO, was found, thus making it possible for this program to continue to get the truth out to the world. The people, folks, at Swiss America Trading stand behind this program, and I want you to stand behind them. Swiss America Trading deals in protecting their clients through non-confiscatable, non-reportable hard assets. Now, you've heard me inform you about the trouble this country is in, both politically and financially, and the time to act is now. Don't wait until it's too late. Call the experts at Swiss America Trading at 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. And have them show you how to protect yourself. Call 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Do it right now and mention my name, William Cooper, for a free newsletter on protecting your future. By protecting your future, folks, you're keeping the future of this program and freedom for the world alive. Call today, 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Do it right now. You'll be glad that you did.
In the mountains up near Sandpoint, north of Naples, Idaho, eagles gathered there together, are the truth, so you might know. Down the road that followed Deep Creek, at the turn that crossed the bridge, federal marshals had the roadblock to mark the siege of Ruby Ridge. There the armies of the enemy slayed your bride and only son, nearly killed your close companion when the shrapnel pierced his lung. We stand with you, Randy Weaver, 'cause your Lord and Savior lives. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is. On that evening, late one August, you were forced to take your stand. There two strangers as they trespass, drew first blood on private land. Governor Andrus, back in Boise, let the enemy tell him lies. And from his anti-Christ decision, Sam and Vicky lost their lives. Federal agents, U.S. Marshals, and FBI men stormed the hill, all on false, fictitious charges, given orders shoot to kill. We stand with you, Randy Weaver, 'cause your Lord and Savior lives. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is. Though the armies of the enemy may surround us in the night. There's a host of heavenly angels hovering near, ready to fight. We stand with you, Randy Weaver. We are proud to call you friend. As we gather here together, stand beside you till the end. We stand with you, Randy Weaver, 'cause your Lord and Savior lives. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is.
Rapid delivery of World of Radio to WRNO is made possible by a grant from George Thurman. Production made possible by a grant from Review of International Broadcasting, the magazine for shortwave listeners. In North America, $2.50 for a sample to Review of International Broadcasting, Box 81874. Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87198 USA. This is Glenn Hauser with World of Radio number 690.
That's the beginning of the show called World of Radio, brought to you by Glenn Hauser. During a recent episode of the World of Radio, Glenn Hauser interviewed George McClinock, the general manager of WWCR. As you all probably know, WWCR was burned to the ground in the early morning of hours of April the 4th, 1993, and that's why we're broadcasting to you now from WRNO in New Orleans. We're going to play for you now a portion of that interview, which will tell you exactly what happened at WWCR on that early Sunday morning, so that you will know, folks, that the enemy is not playing. We've been at war for a long, long time. For those of you who don't understand it, many battles have been fought. Some with loss of life. One occurred in Idaho at the cabin of Randy Weaver. You're going to hear more about that later on this program. The most recent battle was fought in Waco, Texas, the Waco Massacre. And every time I go on the air, folks, I am fighting a part of that battle, and so are many others. So if you weren't aware of it, listen closely. We would like to thank Glenn Hauser for his permission to use this segment of his radio show, The World of Radio.
The World of Radio is a listener-supported public service program about communications around the world, especially shortwave. On this edition, recorded April 15th, it was arson at WWCR. We hear the details and the station's current plans. First, I must make sure you know how to contact me if you have DX News you'd like to phone in for this program or DX Daily. It's 1-505-266-9012. That's 1-505-266-9012. And the P.O. Box in Albuquerque is 81874, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87198, USA. I've also arranged for fax, not at the same phone number as I had previously planned, but at a different number. This is an organization which is willing to receive fax messages from me. However, it's rather inconveniently located, and I probably won't be picking them up every day. I will make a plan about putting them at least on Mondays and Thursdays around midday. If you want to time your fax transmissions, you can send them any time during the 24 hours, and be sure each page is headed for the attention of Glenn Hauser. The number is 505-237-1042. Now, if you're in the U.S. and you think you just got to fax me something, you might reconsider. Perhaps it would do just as well to send it in the U.S. mail. It would still get to me in perhaps 3 or 4 days. But from overseas, it should be especially useful to expedite the arrival of DX News for this program or DX Daily. Again, the fax number, 505-237-1042. But this won't be in effect until Monday, the 19th of April. It's time for an update on the situation at WWCR Nashville, both on their latest plans for coming back and on the investigation into the fire. On Thursday, April 15th, I talked to General Manager George McClinock.
The building at this moment, of course, today is Thursday afternoon. It's got about two tiny walls standing, and everything else has been leveled and hauled, like it's all been hauled away in big giant trucks. The transmitters were hauled away yesterday, and they worked until about 7 o'clock tonight. They've also leveled the land for our temporary building. So both of those will begin momentarily as soon as all this demolition takes place. Temporary building going up pretty quick. We should have both transmitters online, I'd say 5-6 weeks. They're being built in at Continental right now. The antennas were basically undamaged. There were some minor problems, but nothing of major importance. Everything was destroyed. Best guess that everybody can make on it is a gallon of gasoline on a certain portion of the building around the backside between two air intakes where it was fairly well protected from visible aspects. Of course, in the future, we will have surveillance systems out there and alarms running continuously and continuous recording and remote monitoring sensors. So I think our security will pick up 1,000% after this particular problem.
So are you saying you're pretty sure it was arson, and were there traces of gasoline?
No, they have not found traces of gasoline. The gasoline, when it's properly placed, of course, burns up. The fire was started on the outside, right where there is nothing, and it was a rather intense flame, enough to go up and melt the matching transformers insulators on the transmission line, actually melt them. There's nothing on the outside of the building that could produce that kind of flame. It proceeded inside the transmission line window, which is a feed-through window for the RF, went inside there, but first it melted the insulator from the outside, so you know it started on the outside. Then it proceeded to melt the window, which is face-age plastic, and then that pulled out because the transmission line was still connected. It proceeded in the window, up in the wall, into the ceiling, and proceeded to between the ceiling and the roof, which is about 6, 7, 8 inches. I don't know exactly, maybe eight or ten inches. Proceeded along there, and got to the middle part of the building. At approximately the same time it got to the middle part of the building, started to exit the number two transmitters. Window, it went out. When it went out, it melted the window and the transmission line pulled out because it was under tension from the transmission line down in the field, and the insulators were totally undamaged. The fire then was in the middle of the building and the ceiling collapsed, and that was the first sign of real trouble. Actually, the gals at night are operator at night noticed puffs of smoke coming by, and she ran up and down in different buildings looking for, and different transmitters behind them looking for the smoke out of the fire, but there was none that she could observe. And when she came back to the center of the building, she called the fire department, ceiling collapsed, and then she got out.
And there you have it, folks. Arson at WWCR. Fire started from outside where there was nothing that could have started a fire. It did not start in the transmitters or in any of the electrical connections. You heard the testimony from George McClinock being interviewed by Glenn Hauser of World of Radio. And the information, I might add, if we had played that interview a little farther, George McClinock states that the information that he gave us during that interview was directly from the fire investigators. So it's not conjecture. It is what the fire investigators from the fire department have put together, and they state that's what happened. WWCR is planning to be back on the air May 15th, which means if everything goes well and they begin again broadcasting on Saturday, May 15th, that means the hour of the time will resume its broadcasting on WWCR at the same old time slot, just like before, folks. So stay tuned and spread the word to the people who have not been able to receive WRNO so that they'll be ready to listen once again to the hour of the time and all the wonderful, great programming on WWCR, again, beginning May 15th, and that's based upon everything going well. If they have some kind of a problem, it could be held up for a day or two or three or four. So those are the plans. So watch for WWCR to be back on the air again on Saturday, May 15th, or if there's a holdup, shortly thereafter. We're going now to begin a series of episodes of The Hour of the Time. I'm going to read you verbatim, folks, and if you want to, we're going to make this available. I don't know how much it's going to cost yet. Do not send us any money. Don't write and ask for it right now. We'll tell you within the next show or two how much this is going to cost and how you can get it. And, of course, as always, it will be much cheaper for CAGI members than it will be for anyone else. If you would like to obtain this for yourself, you can go to the United States District Court for the District of Idaho and ask for this and get it yourself. It is in the United States District Court for the District of Idaho, United States of America versus Randall C. Weaver and Kevin L. Harris, defendants. This is entitled Memorandum in Support of Defendants' Motions to Disqualify United States Attorney's Office, to Dismiss the Indictment, to Strike for Prejudicial Allegations, to Order an Evidentiary Hearing, for a continuance pending an investigation by the United States Attorney General and pending any interlocutory appeals by the parties. It was filed by G.L. Spence and Kent W. Spence, Spence Moriarty and Schuster, 15 South Jackson Street, Post Office Box 548, Jackson, Wyoming, 83001, and Charles F. Peterson, Gary L. Gilman of Orndorff, Peterson, Holly, White, and Gilman, 1087 West River Street, Suite 230, Boise, Idaho, 83702. This brief was filed on behalf of Randall C. Weaver and Kevin L. Harris, defendants. It is a memorandum in support of defendants' motions. What you're going to hear during this episode of The Hour of the Time, the next several episodes of The Hour of the Time, is what's in this brief verbatim. I'm going to give it to you verbatim as it was filed, folks, and we will be making it available for you if you want to get it from us. If you want to get it from the court, you can. You can. I've already given you the information that you need to get that from the court. Let me give you the numbers just in case you need those. It's criminal numbers 90-90-NHLR:92-0-N-HRL:92-080-N-HLR:92-081-N-HLR. Make sure you don't miss tonight or the next few episodes of The Hour of the Time. These will be rebroadcast on WWCR. The facts. Prior to the so-called standoff at Ruby Ridge, which commenced on August 21, 1992, Randy Weaver was treated by federal authorities as a fugitive from justice. He had been asked by federal undercover agents to provide them with sawed-off shotguns for an agreed price per gun. Mr. Weaver had no prior criminal record of any nature. He had no propensity to commit crimes. However, he was induced by federal authorities to do so and was thereafter immediately confronted by federal agents who demanded that he go undercover for them against the Aryan Nations. And this can be found in Byerly Grand Jury Testimony, page 26. When Weaver refused, a warrant was issued for his arrest. He and Vicky were seized by plainclothes officers when they stopped to help what appeared to be people in distress and took Randy Weaver into custody. And that can be found also in Byerly Grand Jury Testimony, page 30. Mr. Weaver was released on bond, but thereafter allegedly failed to appear at the time the case was set for trial. His reasons now seem obvious. Vicky told reporters in the Wheeland Grand Jury Testimony, page 17, that she would not let Randy go down because he would be railroaded by the federal authorities. The federal authorities had already lied to the Weavers. Why, she reasoned, should they expect different treatment now? Thereafter, Weaver remained at his house on Ruby Ridge with his family for 20 months, during which time federal marshals undertook various strategies to arrest him. United States Deputy Marshal Roderick stated at the preliminary hearing before Magistrate Williams that the marshals had surreptitiously been on the Weaver property on more than a dozen occasions. That's from the 9-10-92 preliminary hearing, page 45. On August 21, 1992, the United States Marshals, under orders not to have contact with any member of the Weaver household, and above all, not to injure any of the Weaver children, undertook what they now call a reconnaissance mission. The Weaver children included Sarah, 16, Sammy, 13, Rachel, 10, and the nursing baby girl, Elisheba, 10 months. Apparently, the marshals intended something quite in excess of a mere reconnaissance mission. Although they were under strict orders not to engage any member of the Weaver family in a confrontation, the officers, in preparation for this alleged reconnaissance mission, went to a shooting range where they spent several hours sighting in their guns. And this is from 822 and 2892, Roderick 302, page 3. Moreover, the marshals brought with them a medic and medical equipment. And that's from 822 and 2892, Roderick 302, page 2, in obvious anticipation that someone would be injured. The marshals knew from their investigation that the Weavers had several times confronted people on their property whom the Weavers suspected were U.S. marshals intent on arresting Randy Weaver. That's from Roderick 9-10-92, Grand Jury Testimony, page 31. The marshals knew that although the Weavers were armed during these confrontations, and even though the Weavers suspected that the persons were marshals, nevertheless, such intruders were confronted without violence and none were injured. That's from 8-27-92, Affidavit of Keith M. Hunter, page 5-5-8, from the Kittle Grand Jury Testimony. The marshals had learned by previous experience that the Weavers would come out of their home whenever the dogs were alerted and that members of the family would investigate when the dogs began to bark. And this is from Roderick 9-10-92, Grand Jury Testimony, page 26. The marshals knew that the Weavers usually carried firearms when they came out of the house, but that they had a long history of non-violence, even under stressful and suspicious circumstances. In face of this history, the marshals' apparent strategy was to engage the Weavers while they were armed, which, even in the face of their alleged orders not to engage the Weavers, would provide the marshals cause to use deadly force against the Weavers. On August 21, 1992, the marshals divided themselves into two teams. Deputy Marshal Roderick sent one team to an area identified as the Y, while the other team, consisting of Roderick, Deegan, and Cooper, entered the Weaver property. Roderick now admits that his team was throwing rocks toward the Weaver house, and this is taken from Roderick Grand Jury Testimony, page 40, thus taunting the dogs. Later, contrary to these admissions by Roderick, Marshal Jack Clough of Moscow, Idaho, told the press that the Weavers had loosed their dogs on an approaching vehicle. And this is from Bonner's Ferry Herald, entitled Clues at Weaver Cabin by Mike Wayland. The dogs were disturbed by the marshals' rock throwing, and the prelude to the forbidden confrontation began. The marshals ran, and as must have been fully anticipated, the family Golden Labrador started to follow the trail. This is from 822 and 2892, Roderick 302, page 7. But having already anticipated that the lab would follow, the marshals had pre-armed Marshal Cooper with a 9mm submachine gun equipped with a silencer for the confessed purpose of shooting the dog. From Roderick Grand Jury Testimony, page 49. As must have been fully anticipated by the marshals, when the dogs began to bark at the taunting officers, Kevin Harris, Randy Weaver, and his 13-year-old son, Sammy Weaver, came out of the house to determine the cause. Also, as fully predicted, the Weavers carried along their hunting long arms. That's from 82792, Affidavit of Keith Hunter, pages 5 through 7. As must have also been anticipated, they followed the dog to see what was causing all of the commotion. The Weavers hoped the dog was on the trail of a large animal, and that was from 9192, Harris 302, page 1. In the meantime, the dog was closing the gap on the marshals with the boys close behind. In accordance with their plan, the marshals took hiding places in the heavy trees and undergrowth along the road and waited for the dog and the two boys to come running by. That's from 822 and 2892, Roderick 302, page 7. They undoubtedly expected Randy Weaver to be with them. Instead, as we have seen, only Kevin Harris and the boy were following the dog. 822 and 2892, Roderick 302, page 7. The dog passed Cooper, but the boys were close behind the dog, so Cooper elected not to shoot the dog because, as he admitted, if he killed the dog, I believed it would precipitate a firefight. This is from the preliminary hearing, Cooper, page 240, 9/11/92. Cooper said, quote, "I just can almost feel the bullets flying at any time," unquote. From the Cooper Grand Jury Testimony, 9/15/92, page 26. He let the dogs pass and took deeper cover in the trees behind Deegan. The dog then passed Roderick and continued up the road 20 to 30 feet. From Roderick, 9/15/92, Grand Jury Testimony, page 53. Since Cooper had not shot the dog as planned, Roderick now fired. Roderick, 9/15/92, Grand Jury Testimony, page 54. The bullet shattered the dog's spine and the dog let out a yelp. Weaver's Harris statement, page 1, back. Since it was shot through the spine, 824-92, Dr. Roland Houston Hall, 302. It likely cried out in great pain, pulling itself about on its front legs for some time before it died, during all of which time the dog was in plain view of the boys. This is from Roderick, 9/15/92, Grand Jury Testimony, page 56. Thus a confrontation, contrary to the marshal's orders, was fully assured. Indeed, a forbidden confrontation with one of the Weaver children. To the horror of 13-year-old Sammy Weaver, he saw a man in a full camouflage suit brutally shoot his dog. This is from Weaver's Harris Statements, page 2. Roderick testified that up to this point, no one he could identify had fired at the officers. Hence, by Roderick's admission, the first shot was fired by Roderick when he shot the family pet. When Sammy saw his dog shot, he yelled, quote, "You shot Striker, you son of a bitch," unquote. Thereafter, Sammy fired his gun, a .23 caliber Mini-14, in Roderick's direction. This is from Weaver Harris Statement, page 2. There is no allegation or suggestion in this case that the boy hit anyone. In the meantime, the officers opened fire with their fully automatic weapons and submachine gun. Kevin Harris said he saw spent brass cartridges flying around and smoke puffs in the bushes where the marshals were hiding. 9192, Harris 302, page 2. At the same time, Harris says he saw Sammy running toward home with his back to the officers. The child was crying out in pain, having been hit in the arm by the marshal's fire. Harris says he heard Randy Weaver, who was out of sight of the shooting, call to his son to come home. That's from 9192, Harris 302, page 2. Then Harris heard the boy call back, quote, "I'm coming, Dad," unquote. Weaver's Harris statement, page 1, back. Those were the last words Sammy ever spoke. There was a lull in the shooting. Then there was another shot, and Sammy cried out, and then there was silence. 9192, Harris 302, page 2. Seeing that Sammy had been shot and fearing for his own life, Harris opened fire in the direction of those who had been shooting from the bushes. He believed he shot the officer who had been firing at Sammy. Weavers, Harris, statement, page 2. After that, Harris made his way up to Sammy's body, examined the boy's body, and found that he was dead, shot through the back as he ran home. Harris, 9192-302, page 3. Don't go away, folks. This is hot stuff. We'll be right back after this very short pause. William Cooper, folks, for Swiss America Trading Corporation. Now, if you followed my broadcast for any length of time, and we've been on since May the 4th, 1992, you know I've been bringing you news of the world, mostly without sponsorship. In part, I've been leery of allowing just any corporation or any business or any company or any person to buy time on my show, and many people made application, and they were all refused except for two, The Pilot Connection and Backwoods Home Magazine. And if you've listened to the show, you know that they only sponsored a couple of episodes each. Well, Backwoods Home Magazine will be back with us in the future. But I'm proud to announce a new alliance with Swiss America Trading Corporation. And Swiss America Trading Corporation and myself are committed to preparing my listening audience for the upcoming economic trauma. And believe me, folks, it's coming. For over 11 years, Swiss America has been supplying over 10,000 clients with hard assets and constant information on how best to protect those assets. And for a limited time, interested listeners can receive a complimentary newsletter if you just mention my name, William Cooper, and ask for the information on, quote, protecting your future, unquote. Now, I've read this, folks, and it's packed full of information that you need to know. It doesn't cost you a thing. Call 1-800-289-2646 right now. Don't procrastinate. Call 1-800-289-2646 today, now. Do it now, and invest the time it takes to read one of the most important publications of our times. Call 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did.
In the mountains up near Sandpoint, north of Naples, Idaho, eagles gathered there together to guard the truth so you might know. Down the road that followed Deep Creek, at the turn that crossed the bridge, federal marshals had the roadblock mark the siege of Ruby Ridge. There the armies of the enemy slayed your bride and only son, nearly killed your close companion when the shrapnel pierced his lung. We stand with you, Randy Weaver, 'cause your Lord and Savior lives wheresoever eagles gather. That is where his body is. On that evening, late one August, you were forced to take your stand there to strangers as they trespassed to first blood on private land. Governor Andrus, back in Boise, let the enemy tell him lies, and from his anti-Christ decision, Sam and Vicky lost their lives. Federal agents, U.S. Marshals, and FBI men stormed the hill, all on false, fictitious charges, given orders shoot to kill. We stand with you, Randy Weaver, 'cause your Lord and Savior lives wheresoever eagles gather. That is where his body is. Though the armies of the enemy may surround us in the night, there's a host of heavenly angels hovering near, ready to fight. We stand with you, Randy Weaver. We are proud to call you friend. As we gather here together, stand beside you till the end. We stand with you, Randy Weaver, 'cause your Lord and Savior lives. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is.
Before the shooting began, Randy Weaver, who had separated from Harris and Sammy, came on to one of the camouflaged marshals, and when he did, Weaver turned and ran. By the time the shooting started, Weaver was out of sight of the Y, running toward the house and calling out to his son to come home. He fired his shotgun into the air and later his pistol, attempting to get the boy's attention. He finally heard his son cry out, quote, "I'm coming, Dad," unquote, from Weaver's Harris statement, page 1 and 2 back. Then Randy Weaver ran onto the house and waited. When the boy did not show up, Randy shot more rounds into the air, trying to attract the boy's attention. Weaver's Harris statement, 1 and 1 back. After the smoke cleared, the U.S. Marshals realized they were in serious trouble. William Deegan, their colleague, was shot through the chest and had died. A child was dead along with the child's dog. Both child and dog were shot in the back. 8/25/92 autopsy report of Samuel Weaver. 8/24/92 Dr. Roland Houston Hall, 302. Although this information has still not been released to the press, the marshals must have realized that these deaths were, in fact, totally attributable to their violation of orders against confrontation and the admonition not to injure any of the Weaver children under any circumstances. Moreover, Deegan's death occurred under circumstances that are still in serious doubt, for although Harris thought he killed Deegan in the melee attempting to defend Sammy and himself, the officers must have known that the circumstances surrounding Deegan's death would soon be fully investigated and that the results might well establish that the officers themselves, not Harris, had killed Deegan during their wild and irresponsible automatic gunfire. As to the boy, no one could mistake him for an adult. This 13-year-old was no larger than an average 10-year-old, 70 to 80 pounds, per the 8/25/92 autopsy report. His voice, when he hollered out that the man had shot his dog, was the voice of a child. The child was shot by the officers running home. They had no warrant to arrest either Harris or the boy. The officers, now responsible for the death of two people, while Weaver himself had escaped, began to consider how to explain their conduct. After Deegan and Sammy were shot, Harris returned to the Weaver house. Randy had arrived before Harris. By this time, no one from the Weaver household was within half a mile of the marshals. Moreover, the landscape is such that hills and dense vegetation intervene between the Y where the marshals hid and where the Weaver house was situated, so that the house was completely out of sight of the Y. Yet the marshals now began to act as if they were under siege. By this time, Hunt, Thomas, and Norris arrived at the Y. Now, all the marshals were soon to claim that they were pinned down in a firefight, and that's from 8/22 and 30/92, Hunt 302, page 7. Despite the supposed rain of fire that, quote, pinned them down, unquote, Hunt and Thomas traveled down the hill to the Rouse residence again without incident. In truth, while the marshals were telling the world that they were under siege and, quote, pinned down by fire, unquote, 9/1/92 affidavit of Richard Rogers, page 1 and 4, the Weavers and Harris had located Sammy's body and carried it back to their residence where they placed the body in what has become known as the birthing shed. There, while the marshals were supposedly pinned down by fire, they claimed for 12 hours until they were rescued by a SWAT team, 9/30/92 Rogers Grand Jury Testimony, page 20, the Weavers, stricken with grief, began to prepare their child for a home burial. In the meantime, the marshals began to spread a false story concerning the incident, a story that would result in the infamous standoff at Ruby Ridge, the death of Vicki Weaver, and the wounding of Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris. Hunt called the sheriff's office and made several other phone calls, including calls to the marshal office. 82292 Hunt 302 page 8. He told Mrs. Rao that the marshals had been ambushed, that the marshals had been fired on, and that the marshals themselves had not fired back. 82692 Rao 302 page 3. He further told the sheriff's office and his own office that the marshals were, quote, pinned down, unquote, by fire. Contrary to the latter sworn testimony of the marshals, Marshal Jack Clough now told the press another false scenario. He told the press that Randy Weaver had opened fire on the marshals, and this is from Bonner's Ferry Herald, Clues at Weaver Cabin by Mike Wayland. Although the marshals admit they never saw Randy Weaver fire a shot in their direction, he also told the press that the marshals returned fire on both Weaver and Harris. And this is from Bonner's Ferry Herald, Clues at Weaver's Cabin by Mike Wayland. The marshals admit they never fired at Weaver. Contrary to the later testimony of the marshals that the dog never attacked them, Clough told the press that the family dog had not only attacked one but two deputies. And this is again from the story in the Bonner's Ferry Herald, Clues at Weaver Cabin by Mike Wayland. The killing of Sammy Weaver and his dog was completely omitted from the marshal's report to the FBI and to the press. They acted instead as if they did not know the killing had taken place, later claiming they did not know that Sammy had been shot or who shot him. Yet the boy screamed out when he was hit and laid on the ground in a pool of his own blood until his body was removed. In fact, law enforcement officials tested the ground for blood in the area where the child's body had lain. The Washington, D.C. office of the U.S. Marshals called in the FBI. This office conveyed the same false story that the marshals were currently pinned down by fire and were under siege, and that a U.S. marshal had been murdered. 93092, Rogers Grand Jury Testimony, page 12 and 13. The FBI mobilized, calling in their crack hostage rescue teams from around the country. They deployed snipers. They called in the National Guard. Armored personnel carriers were sent to Ruby Ridge. Officers from Spokane, Salt Lake City, and Washington, D.C. were mobilized. Hundreds of specially trained agents began to arrive at the scene. Two large government transport planes brought in equipment of all kinds, a helicopter, radio and TV equipment, a robot, and hordes of other equipment. The Red Cross was called in to set up facilities to feed the officers and men. Units of the National Guard were mobilized. What a few hours before had been a peaceful little mountain home was overnight literally turned into a war zone, some claiming there were as many as 400 men with their arms and other war equipment at Ruby Ridge. Based on the false information given them by the marshals, the heads of the FBI teams now briefed their snipers that this was a continuing firefight. And that's from the Rogers Grand Jury, page 14. As is now undisputed at the time of the shooting, Vicky was at the house with her baby. But the marshals told the FBI, and the FBI told its snipers, that the real force behind the Weavers was Vicky Weaver herself. She was the fanatical one, the religious zealot who might kill the children and herself. 93092 Rogers Grand Jury Testimony, page 10. Are you beginning, folks, to see the similarities between what happened at Randy Weaver's cabin in Idaho and the Waco massacre? I hope you're listening to this, and I hope you understand what it is that you're hearing. For what you're hearing is so important that I cannot impress upon you enough how important it is. Allegedly, the Weavers embraced the precepts of the Aryan Nations, an organization of right-wing religious radicals who taught white supremacy. 93092 Rogers Grand Jury Testimony, page 22. Before the briefing was over, the Weavers were characterized as skinhead types led by the fanatical Vicky, who, unless somehow neutralized, would prevent the other members of the family from surrendering. Today, the FBI claims it was never told by the marshals of Sammy's death, and that the first time the FBI learned of Sammy's death was when one of the FBI agents, during the siege that followed, found his naked body in the birthing shed. 9/30/92, Rogers' grand jury testimony, page 69 and 70. The negotiator for the FBI, when informed of this, said he immediately thought, quote, "My God, the Weavers are killing their own children," unquote. That's from Lancely, grand jury testimony, page 75. The story relayed to the FBI and thereafter by the FBI to the media was simple, to the point, and again, false. The marshals had been attacked by the Weaver clan, and that these white supremacists had killed Officer Dagan, and that the officers were under siege and pinned down by fire. Moreover, the FBI told the media, as well as this court, that the Weaver children themselves were being held hostage and being used by their parents as, quote, "human shields," unquote. And folks, that is exactly the same story that they gave the press and you sheeple out there that condemned 86 people at the Waco massacre to death by fire. And this, folks, is taken right out of the 8/27/92 affidavit of Keith Hunter, page 4, and also a story written in the Bonner's Ferry Herald, Clues at Weaver Cabin, by Mike Wayland. On their way to the siege site, the FBI established what the FBI calls, quote, "rules of engagement," unquote. That is, rules by which the FBI snipers and assaulters might kill the Weavers and Kevin Harris. These rules were intended by their operation to eliminate all of the adults at the Weaver residence, including Vicki Weaver, for as the FBI already knew, when any of the adult Weavers came out of the house, they usually carried a weapon. 8/27/92, affidavit of Keith Hunter, page 5 through 7. And would, therefore, under these rules of engagement, be shot. Under these rules, the FBI could eliminate all witnesses who might have otherwise given testimony as to the illegal acts committed by the officers at the Y as described above. At the same time, the killing of all of the adults would, of course, avenge Deegan's death. Richard Rogers, the commander of the hostage rescue team, testified that the FBI's first rules of engagement were that any armed adult at the Weaver residence should be killed, whether they were menacing anyone or not. 9/30/92, Rogers grand jury testimony, page 16, et sequitur. For example, if an adult came out the door with a weapon, presumably even a BB gun, that adult should be, quote, "neutralized," unquote. If the adult laid down in the sun with a gun over his stomach, presumably he would be killed. Indeed, the mere possession of a weapon of any kind was apparently sufficient under these rules for any adult at the scene to be, quote, "eliminated," unquote. These rules of engagement were illegal, since the FBI possesses no power to change the law in order to permit officers to kill when the officers or others are not in imminent danger of death or serious bodily injury. These illegal rules of engagement were to be executed by expert snipers who surrounded the house and who were armed with Model 700 Remington single-shot target rifles equipped with 10 power scopes and especially designed for precision shooting at great distances, distances up to 1,000 yards. 9/17/92, Horiuchi grand jury testimony, pages 22 and 23. The snipers were also supplied with deadly accurate match-grade ammunition. When the FBI teams arrived at the scene, the marshals were obviously not under siege. The local sheriff had gone to the Y and led the marshals out without incident. Yet the record is silent on any attempt by the FBI to make an independent inquiry of their own to determine the existence of any danger to anyone before the FBI loosed their snipers on the Weavers. There is nothing in the record to show that the FBI made an attempt to independently determine what had actually occurred at the Y before they decided to shoot the Weavers. No effort of any kind was made to set up communication with the Weavers before the snipers opened fire. Instead, the FBI, nearly ignorant of the facts, adopted the position of the marshals that the Weavers were fanatics who would kill any federal officer who came in contact with them, their own children and themselves as well, that none would surrender unless Vicky surrendered, and that this was a continuing firefight. That's from Lansley Grand Jury Testimony, page 14, Rogers Grand Jury Testimony, page 14. And folks, you notice that they're assigning to Vicki Weaver the same role that they signed to David Koresh in the Waco Massacre. Now, the snipers established their own strategies to kill all of the adults. They decided that if any adult came out of the house, they would await until all of the adults came out before opening fire. That way, they could kill them all. And that's exactly straight out of the 9-17-92 Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 72, out of their own mouth. Toward the evening of August 22, 1992, Sarah, the 16-year-old, accompanied by Randy and Kevin Harris, decided to have one last look at Sammy before he was buried. They walked out the front door of the house, headed toward the birthing shed. This is from Weaver's Harris statement, page 2 back. Across the way, Sierra 4, an expert sniper team consisting of Lon Horiuchi and Dale Monroe, were set up at about 200 yards. 9-17-92 Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 61. Horiuchi said he saw the three come out of the house. He did not realize that the female was Sarah. 9-17-92 Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 55. But Horiuchi said he saw no rifle in the female's hands. 9-17-92 Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 33. He was zeroed in on Harris, whom he says he recognized from his size, although the snipers had also been provided pictures of all three adults. 9-17-92 Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 38. Weaver could not possibly be confused for Harris if the officers were, indeed, attempting to discriminate between the parties rather than setting out to kill them all. The two were not dressed alike, did not look alike, were years apart in age, and Harris was over a foot taller than Weaver. Horiuchi, however, claims that even though he was observing through his 10-power scope at only 200 yards, he mistook Weaver for Harris. This sniper had such an accurate view of his target that he was able to see his own bullet splatter into the birthing house. 9-17-92 Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 50. It was, of course, Randy Weaver, not Harris, who stood at the door, his back to the sniper. 9-17-92 Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 49. As Randy reached up to open the door, Horiuchi fired. The bullet traversed through the soft flesh under his arm. When Horiuchi opened fire, all three ran toward the house. 9-17-92 Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 53. Horiuchi says he followed Harris in his scope, that Harris was bringing up the rear. 9-17-92 Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 54. Horiuchi omits saying anything about seeing Vicky, who was standing at the door with her baby in her arms. Weaver Harris statement, page 2, back 3. The door had a window in it, and Vicky would have been clearly visible through Horiuchi's 10-power scope. Horiuchi now claims he shot Vicky by mistake. 9-17-92 Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 70. But the wounds on Vicky show that the bullet entered Vicky's head first, at the cheek, went through the mouth and tongue, blew through the jawbone, cut the carotid artery. 8-31-92 autopsy report on Vicky Weaver. And if indeed the same bullet hit Kevin Harris, it hit him secondarily. Vicky screamed and continued to scream, 9-17-92 Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 61, until within minutes she bled to death in a kneeling position at the floor. She died with the baby still in her arms. From the Weavers Harris statement, page 3. You'll have to forgive me, folks, because this affects me emotionally, and it's very difficult to read this and maintain any kind of a composure. Harris suffered massive wounds in the arm and wounds into his chest cavity. The number of shots fired is in serious question. Horiuchi claims he fired only twice, and that the third shot heard by other snipers might have been an echo. 9/17/92, Horiuchi Grand Jury Testimony, page 63. As to the killing of Vicky, Horiuchi seemingly believed that Sarah was Vicky. When Sarah ran into the house, so far as Horiuchi was concerned, it was Vicky running into the house. When Vicky stood holding the door open, her head in plain sight, he shot Vicky, who was an easy, standing target. The FBI now faced a serious problem. They had killed an unarmed mother standing at the door with her baby in her arms. They had no warrant for Vicky and were not likely to ever get one. 9/30/92, Rogers Grand Jury Testimony, page 30. Moreover, the FBI had discovered that Vicky had not been involved in the shooting at the Y. 9/30/92, Rogers Grand Jury Testimony, page 30. It appears, therefore, that after Vicky was shot, the officers realized they had no legal or moral justification for having killed Vicky. Good night, folks, and God bless you all.
In the mountains up near Sandpoint, north of Naples, Idaho, eagles gathered there together to guard the truth, so you might know. Down the road that followed Deep Creek, at the turn that crossed the bridge, federal marshals had the roadblock to mark the siege of Ruby Ridge. There the armies of the enemy slayed your bride and only son, nearly killed your close companion when the shrapnel pierced his lung. We stand with you, Randy Weaver, 'cause your Lord and Savior lives. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is. On that evening, late one August, you were forced to take your stand. There two strangers as they trespass, drew first blood on private land. Governor Andrus, back in Boise, let the enemy tell him lies. And from his anti-Christ decision, Sam and Vicky lost their lives. Federal agents, U.S. Marshals, and FBI men stormed the hill, all on false, fictitious charges, given orders shoot to kill. We stand with you, Randy Weaver, 'cause your Lord and Savior lives. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is. Though the armies of the enemy may surround us in the night, they're the hosts of heavenly angels hovering near, ready to fight. We stand with you, Randy Weaver. We are proud to call you friend. As we gather here together, stand beside you till the end. We stand with you, Randy Weaver, 'cause your Lord and Savior lives. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is. Wheresoever eagles gather, that is where his body is.